Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is September 30th, Tuesday. We're going to finish up Chapter 4 today, which is Enzymes and Energy, and move on to Cellular Respiration. Some more little chemistry chapters, maybe some biochemistry involved with this stuff. All right, so last time, like I said, we were talking about enzymes and energy. We have to finish up just a couple slides with that chapter, but since I've opened up the PowerPoint on that, let's maybe just review a little bit. How's that? Too dark? Good? I think that's good. All right, so the schedule is, we said today's the 30th, indeed. That's a Tuesday. So when is the next test? 1, 2, 3. Right? 1, 2, 3. 3 weeks from today. Exam number 2, chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9. 9 is autonomic nervous system. You know a lot about the autonomic nervous system already, but we'll look at some of the physiology involved with that. So make sure you go and review your anatomy of the autonomic nervous system. Right? It's just not typically like the somatic motor system. Sounds like my... Is that red? Or green?
Red.
Ah, okay. It just stopped working. I'm going to switch the batteries out so I don't have to yell at everybody. And I got a couple batteries. Good. Well, as I'm switching the batteries out, let's review autonomic nervous system just a little bit. What are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? In other words, what does the autonomic nervous system control? Who remembers that from anatomy? Effector organs. What does an effector organ produce? It produces a response. Yeah, what are some of the autonomic responses in your body? What are some of those effector organs that do that for us? Heart rate. Yeah, so cardiac muscle. Autonomic nervous system. Effector organ is heart muscle, cardiac muscle. Here it goes. Nice. What about skeletal muscle? No, that's under somatic control. That's voluntary control. What's another kind of muscle? Smooth, thank you. Smooth muscle. And do you have control of smooth muscle? No, it's under autonomic control. All right, so you got cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. One more thing. Glands, that's right. So autonomic nervous system controls smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands. And your somatic motor nervous system just controls skeletal muscle. And that's really the only thing that you have voluntary control of in your body is just skeletal muscle. Okay, so that's, make sure you know the pathways for that autonomic nervous system so that we can have a good lecture on the 16th of October. All right, and then the next Monday after that is your second exam. All right, so let's get back to any questions on the schedule at all? Questions? All right, so let's get back to reviewing what we learned last time. What is an enzyme? But so we'll just start talking about what an enzyme is. What is an enzyme? It's a protein. I like that. 99.999% of the time it's a protein. Sometimes it's a nucleic acid, but usually it's a protein. What else? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. That's wonderful. That's what you should know about an enzyme. But you should probably also know a little bit about how it does that. How does it speed up the rate of a chemical reaction? It lowers the activation energy barrier, right? And that's what we see on this slide right here, right? And this is just a plot of free energy versus the process of this particular reaction. And on the left-hand side is that reaction in an uncatalyzed state. And on the right-hand side is with an enzyme. And an enzyme is just another way of saying catalyst, but it's a biological catalyst, right? Like a nucleic acid or protein. All right, and so this little barrier wall right here is what we call the activation energy. Without the enzyme, you can see the activation energy is greater than when an enzyme is present. So it takes less energy to get this reaction going. Now, what about this particular reaction with reactants here and products? Same on the right-hand side, reactants and products. Is this an endergonic or exergonic reaction? Exergonic, because the products have less energy compared to the reactants, which means then some energy is given off. Now, how much energy is given off between the non-catalyzed and the enzyme-catalyzed reaction? Is it different? Is it equal, the same, or does it change? Does the enzyme change the thermodynamics of this particular reaction? Does an enzyme release more energy, or is the energy released, since we said this is exergonic, is the energy released the same? And how would you know? Yeah, because you would look at this green arrow right here, compare the two columns, we see here and here, and that arrow is exactly the same height. So enzymes do not change. The thermodynamics doesn't change whether a reaction is endergonic or exergonic. And if it is exergonic, doesn't change the amount of energy that's released. It only speeds up the rate of that chemical reaction. Okay. All right. And what has to form before products can form? This enzyme-substrate complex. Right? So that means substrates, you could consider these things reactants, have to bind to an enzyme. Where do substrates bind to an enzyme? At the active site. And what's the relationship between the active site and the substrates? So the active site has to be designed for the substrates, but in what sense? Is it color? Shape. Ah, shape. I like shape. Yeah, so it's mostly by the shape. Good lock and key model you should think of. Right. And if the shape of the active site changes, maybe because there's a drastic change in temperature, pH, or salt concentration, then what happens to the activity of the enzyme when the shape of the active site changes? Yeah, it changes as well. Usually it's reduced. Right? Okay. And does the enzyme get used up during the reaction? No, it does not. What gets used up? Substrates get used up, and what gets produced? Products, that's right. So this enzyme is the same no matter where it is. That's going to be some important concepts for what we're talking about today. Also, here's a really good definition. What's the name of an enzyme that will add a phosphate group to a molecule? That is a kinase. What's the name of an enzyme that takes a phosphate group off of a molecule? That's a phosphatase. And we're going to be using these two enzymes a lot in this class, so just get familiar with their terminology. That will make your life a lot easier. Okay, so I'm going to zoom over all this stuff. Make sure you know the difference between a coenzyme and a cofactor. Tell me something about a cofactor. Is it big or small?
Small.
Is it organic or inorganic? It's inorganic. A coenzyme is big or small? It's big. And is it organic or inorganic? A coenzyme is, just like an enzyme, it is organic. All right. And that's kind of where we left off. Oh, don't forget about these two laws of thermodynamics, but I think we covered those pretty well in lecture. Okay. So remember, endergonic reactions can take place. So remember the building blocks that I had right here, the little dominoes? And we went from a building to just a knock down the building, just had a random arrangement of dominoes. All right, so that released energy. When the building fell down, that released energy. But when I took the dominoes on the table and made a building out of it, all right, so that went from high entropy to low entropy. What did that require for me to build some structure? It required energy. That's right. So you can decrease entropy in a system as long as you put energy into it. Right, so our bodies is like building a building, and we can maintain that low entropy state by doing what? By taking in energy. So energy is required to maintain that state. And that's what this diagram here says. Right, endergonic reactions can happen as long as they get energy from another set of chemical reactions that are exorganic. And we could think of the little small wheel on the side as producing ATP. So that is an endergonic reaction, and in order for your body to make ATP, what has to go along with that? What has to happen at the same time? An exorganic reaction. There have to be molecules that contain more energy in them than there is in ATP, and as they are broken down, then ATP can be synthesized. ATP is the universal energy carrier in your body. Here you see that nice diagram of ATP. All right, so make sure you know what ATP is and NAD. And that pretty much takes us to where we were, where we ended. We ended right here last time. So, a cofactor can bind to an enzyme to change its activity. It can increase the rate or decrease the rate. And a coenzyme is a molecule that brings intermediates to a reaction. So it's shuttling things around inside the cell, bringing molecules to one kind of reaction or another. Right. And as a matter of fact, you could think of ATP as a carrier molecule. It's carrying something from one set of chemical reactions to another. Acts like a bridge or a carrier molecule. Now, what is it carrying? What's the best way to think of ATP? What is it carrying from one set of chemical reactions to another? Energy. That's really nice if you see that. It's actually carrying energy from one part of your cell to another in the form of chemical energy. And later today, we're going to see that it's actually carrying something else, and that is this phosphate group. And when it transfers a phosphate group, because this is a high-energy bond right here, it just automatically transfers energy as well. But if you think of ATP as a coenzyme carrying energy or transferring energy, that's a really nice way of thinking about that. All right, so that's the structure of ATP. We're going to look at a bunch of reactions that are called oxidation-reduction reactions. And sometimes this is really confusing, but you should always just really go back to the basic definition of what oxidation is or what reduction is and memorize that, write it out a couple times, and when you get confused, just always go back to that initial definition of what a reduction is or what an oxidation is. And here is the definition. If a molecule gains electrons, we say it is reduced. So gain electrons, reduce. The opposite of that, if a molecule loses electrons, it becomes oxidized. There are various ways that you can remember this, like Leo Gur, lose electrons, lose electrons, oxidation, Gur, like when a lion gurs, gain electrons, reduction. Okay? So there's a couple little mnemonics that you can use to remember this, but when you gain electrons, then that molecule becomes reduced. Right, which means that a reducing agent is some kind of agent that can reduce another molecule. Right, so a reducing agent is a molecule that can give electrons away to another molecule. Reducing agent donates electrons. So a reducing agent has to be reduced to begin with in order for it to give electrons away. And an oxidizing agent accepts those electrons. Right, and when it accepts electrons, that oxidizing agent becomes reduced. And then whatever it's working with becomes oxidized. That's why we call it an oxidizing agent. And so take a look at these terms. You're going to have to think about this. Sleep on it a number of nights. Don't try to memorize what this means the night before the exam because it's kind of tricky to understand all of that stuff. All right, here is something else. Oxidation reaction cannot take place if there is no reduction reaction happening at the same time. These things have to happen at the same time. Right, so reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. Right, they often involve transfers of hydrogen atoms instead of electrons, but I'm not going to use that concept at all in this class. I'm only going to talk about the transfer of electrons. Transfer of electrons. And if you want to think in terms of protons, you're welcome to do that, but my lectures will be based on electrons instead. So if a molecule accepts electrons, what happens to it? Does it become oxidized or reduced when it accepts electrons? It becomes reduced, right? And what happens to the molecule then that donated those electrons? It becomes oxidized. So they have to happen together, right? One cannot happen without the other. So there are certain kinds of large organic compounds in our body that are specialized for carrying these electrons around because these electrons carry energy with them. And these coenzymes are called NAD and FAD. And I don't think you have to really know the names of these things. I don't want to take time to see if I remember what they are right now. But if I have time later, I'll tell you what they are. You can do a Google or Wikipedia on them. But these are large organic molecules that can either become oxidized or reduced, and when they're reduced, they gain electrons, and there is a lot of energy in those electrons. So NAD and FAD not only carry electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another, but they also carry energy from one set of reactions to another, sort of a lot like ATP. So NAD, FAD are also vitamins, and I have them both on this slide right here, and these are not exam figures. And I know these are really hard to see because there's a lot of different elements that make this up, but you might be able to appreciate that you see like an ATP design to them, and that's that adenine in the nucleotide designation of this molecule, and it just so happens that this molecule can accept electrons, right? They get positioned right on this base, right? And it also accepts a couple protons, but it accepts two electrons. So NAD plus is the oxidized form, and when it accepts electrons from another molecule, it becomes reduced. When it becomes reduced, we call it NADH. So NADH is the reduced form. Which one has more energy associated with it, NAD plus or NADH? NADH, because it's carrying the high energy electrons. And if it has that extra energy, then this molecule can transfer that energy to another chemical or do work with that energy. So NADH is an important molecule in our body. All right. So there are two electrons for every NADH that is produced from NAD+. All right. And I guess that makes sense because notice that NAD is a cation. I see a positive charge. And if it gains two electrons, then NADH would be negative, but it also accepts a proton. And what's the charge on a proton? A plus. All right, so that's two pluses. NAD is a plus, the proton is a plus, and with two electrons, then it just becomes a neutral molecule. NADH is neutral, but it is reduced. Here is a molecule that's kind of a cousin to NAD, and it is FAD. And again, you can see the nucleotide nature of this molecule. It's a little bit more complicated because of this other functional group that's on it, but it can also accept two electrons at this position right here, and it can also accept two hydrogens. So notice FAD is not an ion. It's just a neutral molecule in terms of electrical charge, so that when it gains two electrons, in order to stay neutral, FAD with two electrons then becomes FADH2, right? The two H's electrically neutralize the two electrons. But the most important thing I want you to know about these things is, number one, are these cofactors? No. Who saw no, and why did you say no? Yeah, they're coenzymes, but how come they're not cofactors? Because a cofactor is a small metal ion, like calcium or magnesium or manganese or calcium, right? That's not any of these things. These things are much more complicated. They're big, large, organic molecules. Okay. And what they're transferring is energy in the form of some high energy electrons. All right, big organic molecules. That's it for this chapter. Who's got a question about chapter 4, enzymes and energy? Yeah. Energy in terms of chemical energy can be stored in the form of glucose, and glucose can be stored in your body in the form of glycogen. Okay, so glycogen is a good storage form of energy. Glucose is a pretty good storage form of energy. Another good storage form of energy is a triglyceride. So energy can be stored in all kinds of different chemical ways inside your body. I would say probably the two most important is adipose tissue in the form of triglycerides, and in the liver and muscle in the form of glycogen. And a triglyceride, the important energy molecule there are the fatty acids, and in glycogen, the important energy molecule there is glucose. Glucose and fatty acids, important energy molecules, but those can't be used to drive many endergonic reactions. The molecule that does drive endergonic reactions in your body, like muscle contraction, is ATP. So when you need that ATP, then your body goes to triglycerides and glycogen, gets the energy out of glycogen and fatty acids to make ATP, so you can have a bunch of endergonic reactions taking place, like muscle contraction, for instance. That's an excellent question for the following reason, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about in the next chapter. And did I ask you to ask that question? Are you a plant in the crowd? No, that was an excellent question. That leads us right into the next chapter, which is cellular respiration. Yeah. Oh, question, yeah.
Which one has more energy, NAD or FAD?
There's significantly more, 30% more energy in NADH than there is in FADH2. NADH has 30% more energy than FADH2. So they are not equal. NADH has more energy. Yeah. So we'll, that's important when we look at this particular chapter. All right. Well, this chapter is good because we've got to combine chemistry with some psychology, with some things that we know about organelles inside the cell. And I'm sure there's some really good exam figures in here. All right. I want to go over a couple definitions before we get to this thing right here. Here's an important exam figure, and we're going to analyze this figure pretty soon. But let's talk about metabolism, because cellular respiration can mean a number of, well, respiration can mean a number of different things. It could mean ventilation. It could be breathing in and out of your lungs. It could mean the exchange of gases. It could mean the importation of glucose, of oxygen into your body, the export of carbon dioxide. But in terms of cellular respiration, In terms of cellular respiration, what we're interested in is how our body makes ATP, the chemical reactions in the synthesis of ATP. So we're going to start with something a little bit more fundamental. We're going to talk about metabolism. First, we'll define what metabolism is. Metabolism is just the sum of all biological reactions, all chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. That's metabolism. So it's chemistry. Metabolism is chemistry. So it involves substrates and products, or reactants and products, and the chemical reactions that relate those two things together. And furthermore, we can break metabolism down into two forms. One form will break molecules down, the other form will build molecules up. And we got names for that. Catabolism is the breakdown of large molecules. Catabolism is you start with a large molecule, you end up with smaller ones, and when that happens, right, that releases energy. So catabolism is exorganic. Like if you have ATP being broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate, that's a catabolic reaction, the breakdown. And does that require energy or release energy if it's a catabolic reaction? It releases energy. And you're familiar with ATP, right? It's supposed to release energy. Primary source of energy for making ATP, okay, then is catabolism of other kinds of molecules like glucose, right? When ATP is broken down and energy is released, ATP has to be resynthesized, right? And when we take two small molecules and put them together, we call that anabolism. So anabolism can take place, right, if there is some other catabolic reaction that supplies the energy for anabolism. So anabolism takes makes larger molecules from smaller ones, but when that happens, that requires energy. That other energy we're going to see is in the form of fatty acids and glucose, which was wonderful why you asked that question. All right, so anabolism is a way that we can make a large energy storage compounds in our body. And we just mentioned that just by chance, which was what? Glycogen and triglycerides are these large molecules where energy can be stored. All right, so remember, catabolism, breakdown, releases energy. Anabolism builds large molecules, requires energy for that to happen. All right, so here is a really important slide. Whenever you read anything in this particular chapter, answer questions, all right, or even read a subsection in this chapter, I want you to think of it in terms of this illustration right here. So it's really important that you get an overall flow of what's happening inside your body. So not just inside a cell or inside your circulatory system, but your whole body. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4. I see 4 different compartments, 4 different areas on this illustration. Do you see these 4 different areas? I see 4 different rows, like 1, 2, 3, 4. And I think the background has a little bit different color for each of these rows. What's the background color for the bottom row? What color does that look like? Mustard yellow. What's the third row look like? More of another yellow? Lighter yellow? Beige. Green. Okay, brown. No, brown. Beige is a brown color, right? Okay, so you got like a yellow, a brown. What's the second row? red, and what's the first row? Pink. So we got pink, red, brown, yellow. So those are four different compartments that we're going to look at. Right? And this top row, we got two columns. The top row, we got two columns. We got your digestive tract, and we have the liver. And usually we think of the liver as part of the digestive system, and it is, but on this diagram, think of them as two separate places. All right, and this kind of tells us two states that our body can be in. And I do want you to write this down on this slide. So here you have the digestive tract. And after a meal, of course, you have food moving through the digestive tract. Part of that food is our carbohydrates, which then get broken down to glucose. Right, and that glucose in your digestive tract then will be absorbed into the blood. So the second row right here is your vascular system. Right, so when you see this first column on the first row, that signifies that you have eaten a meal and that there is digesting material in your digestive tract. We call that the fed state, F-E-D. You're in a fed state. You're digesting food. Right. When you look at the liver right here, you're not in the fed state. This represents, right, the first thing when you wake up in the morning. You haven't eaten anything in a long time, right? And that's not a fed state. We call that the fasted state, right? So your body can be in one of these two particular states, fed state, when there's glucose in your digestive tract, or when you're in a fasted state, you have glucose in your liver, but you don't have glucose in your digestive tract. Now, what can you tell me about blood glucose levels? They're homeostatically controlled, right? They shouldn't vary a lot over a period of time. They can go up and down a little bit, right? But when you're in a fed state, that blood glucose comes from food that you've eaten. When you're no longer digesting, your blood glucose should not go down because then the glucose in the liver is released and put into the blood. So glucose can come from these two sources depending on whether you're in a fed or fasted state. Does that sort of make sense? Okay. So blood glucose is maintained no matter where it comes from. Fasted state from the liver, fed state from the digestive tract. So now you have glucose that's in the blood and it can move via diffusion from blood into the cell. Right, but it needs a passport to get inside of this. So here we have a cell. This beige is inside the cell. So you could think of a plasma membrane right here. And there is a hormone that's necessary for this glucose to move into the cell through the plasma membrane. It's not really drawn on the slide, but think of a plasma membrane right here. What is that passport signal that allows glucose to enter a cell? It is insulin, right? Without insulin, this glucose is trapped in the blood, can't get into cells, and it just stays in the blood, right? With insulin, glucose can enter the cell. So this beige area is cytoplasm, right? As a matter of fact, maybe you should say cytosol. So maybe just draw in cytosol. All right, and in the cytosol, glucose can be broken down. Oh, it says cytoplasm right here. Cytoplasm can also mean organelles. And that might be a little confusing. So that's why I like to put cytosol instead of cytoplasm. All right, so glucose can be broken down into pyruvic acid. Right, and can somebody tell me how many carbons does glucose have? That's got six. And when it's broken down, it just gets clipped in half. So pyruvate, right, glucose can be broken down into two pyruvic acids or pyruvate molecules. Pyruvic acid and pyruvate are exactly the same molecule, just a little bit different name to it. All right, so you could probably tell me how many carbons does pyruvate have or pyruvic acid? It's got three. That's right. You take glucose with six, chop it in half, exactly equal, then you end up with a three-carbon molecule pyruvic acid. But how many of them do you get from each glucose? You get two. Yeah, so if you want to draw, you put a one for glucose and a two for pyruvic acid, that's great. You could do that. This process of glucose being converted into two pyruvic acids is called glycolysis. What can you tell me about this lysis, the suffix here? What does lysis mean?
Breakdown
of glucose. That's just what that means. Not too complicated. All right. And this process we see happening in the cytosol can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. And what that means is in the presence or in the absence of oxygen. So when the cell is being starved of oxygen, this process happens anyway. It does not require oxygen. Right, so glycolysis, commonly referred to as anaerobic. It happens under anaerobic conditions, but it also happens when there's oxygen inside the cell. Now, where does glycolysis take place inside the cell? In the nucleus? You'd say no. Inside an organelle? You'd say no. You'd just say cytosol, right? Just within all the fluid on the inside of the cell. All right, so that's pyruvic acid. That's going to release some energy because glucose going to 2-pyruvate is what? Anabolism or catabolism? That's catabolism. That's the breakdown. It is exergonic. And guess what your body can do with an exergonic reaction? It can take that energy and make ATP out of it. Okay? So that's why we say that ATP production is always coupled with exergonic reactions because it needs energy in order to proceed. Okay. And if we look at pyruvic acid, what are the two fates? How many fates are there? Sorry. How many fates are there for pyruvic acid? There are two. Okay. One fate is to stay in the cytosol and participate in something we call anaerobic respiration, or it can leave the cytosol and enter a mitochondria. So this fourth row right here is now inside a mitochondria. Right. Anaerobic respiration is in the cytosol. Anytime pyruvic acid enters a mitochondria, that can only happen under aerobic conditions, only when oxygen is present. So mitochondria need oxygen to function, and they're really ornery and nasty when they don't get oxygen. Right? So mitochondria functions just fine, and they're very beneficial to us when oxygen is present. So that's why when we look at this slide, we see anaerobic respiration in the cytosol, aerobic respiration in what compartment inside the cell? Mitochondria. Okay. All right. The most important thing on this slide is, or the most important concept, the most important thing is not even drawn on this slide. And I don't want to tell you right now what it is. I want you to figure that out. Right? By far, the most important thing is not written out on this slide anywhere. And by this week, I want you to be able to write that in after we talk about this. I know, pretty confusing. But you got to figure it out to know what's going on. Okay, so pyruvic acid has two fates. If there's no oxygen present, it gets converted into lactic acid through a pathway we call anaerobic respiration. That happens in skeletal muscle. But if oxygen is present, then pyruvic acid can enter mitochondria, and there, all those carbons in pyruvic acid are converted into CO2. How many carbons are in a CO2? There's one. So how many carbon dioxides are produced for every glucose? There are six. Okay, and the way that happens is through a couple pathways. Right? This pyruvic acid enters the Krebs cycle. Okay, and in so doing, it loses one carbon, and then through the Krebs cycle, loses two more, which is three for every pyruvic acid. And then it generates some high-energy electrons that get transported to something we call the electron transport chain, and that's a part of aerobic respiration. All right, so electrons get transported from the Krebs cycle to the electron transport chain. And what kind of molecules do you know about that can transfer high-energy electrons from one metabolic pathway to another? NADH and FADH2. All right, so when electrons are transferred to the, and we can just put down ETC for electron transport chain, we're going to be concerned with NADH and FADH2 because those are the reduced forms of FAD and NAD+. And so they're carrying these high-energy electrons. All right, does anybody have a guess what the most important thing on this slide is, and it's not even here? Not yet. Good. Okay, we need to think about that a little bit. What else do I want to say about this? Under what conditions can pyruvic acid enter a mitochondria? What conditions inside the cell? Yeah, it's transported in. Insulin is necessary for glucose going from the blood into the cytosol through the plasma membrane. So you need insulin at this step. Don't need insulin for this step, for pyruvic acid entering a mitochondria. But there is another molecule. It's not a hormone. That's a hint. You need oxygen. Oxygen has to be present. That's why all of this stuff right here is what we call aerobic respiration, Krebs cycle, electron transport chain, aerobic respiration, but glycolysis, and production of lactic acid happens under anaerobic conditions without oxygen. Yeah. Okay. This is true. Lactic acid is produced not through an aerobic process, but through an anaerobic process. We're going to look at some details of that to fill in some concepts. All right. What I think I would like for you to see on this slide is that anaerobic respiration happens in the cytosol. Aerobic respiration happens in mitochondria. So I just want like an anatomical understanding of where these things happen at the moment. Okay. And in order for pyruvic acid to enter mitochondria, that only happens when oxygen is present, or we say what? Aerobic conditions. Yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah, two arrows right here. Okay. So we got a bunch of arrows in a circle. That signifies Krebs cycle. This arrow right here, your book does a kind of poor job with that, so I think maybe I would like for you to label this right now. This is a reaction that I call the preparatory reaction. It's a pre-reaction to Krebs cycle, but you're going to see it's very important. So this little arrow right here, preparatory reaction. And then these arrows in a circle, that's Krebs cycle. And then you have the electron transport chain over here. And then, so what's after things are, under anaerobic conditions, is CO2 produced under anaerobic conditions? You saw no. Yeah, I don't see any CO2 produced. Under what conditions does your body produce CO2? Under aerobic conditions. All right, so CO2 is produced through this metabolism, this cellular respiration scheme. What's another molecule that's being produced by aerobic respiration? Yeah, that's great. So water is really kind of a magic molecule. It's not only the solvent that our body is dissolved in, but it's an important metabolite or substrate in many chemical reactions, including this electron transport chain. Because you're familiar with what? Dehydration synthesis. You're aware of hydrolysis reactions. So again, water participates in many important biochemical reactions in your body. Right. And as a matter of fact, water is the last molecule that is produced by cellular respiration, in particular aerobic respiration. All right, so what is the point of cellular respiration? Is it to get rid of glucose? I see glucose going away. Is it to produce pyruvic acid? Is it to produce lactic acid? Is it to produce CO2? Is it to produce water? You need water. Is the point of cellular respiration to make water? And you're going to see the answer is no. Okay. In order for mitochondria to make CO2 and water, what's an obligatory molecule that has to be present? Because it's aerobic conditions, oxygen has to be present. So is the purpose of cellular respiration to get rid of oxygen? All right, so all those answers are no, because the real answer is not on this slide. We got to figure out what it is. Right? So cellular respiration is not to get rid of glucose, not to make pyruvic acid, not to make CO2, not to make water, not to get rid of oxygen, but to do something else. And let's start looking and see what that something else is. Okay, I'll give you a hint. And you're hitting the nail on the head, because this reaction right here, these are all exorganic reactions, which means what? What do they do for energy? They release energy. They release all these reactions right here release energy, and in so doing, your body can use that energy to do something else. All right. Let's look at this first step right here. Glycolysis. Where does glycolysis take place? Cytosol, inside the cell, right? And what does that mean? Is it the building of something? No, it's the breaking down of glucose into what? Into two molecules. You snip glucose into exactly two molecules that we call pyruvic acid. All right, so glucose lysis or glycolysis is a metabolic pathway, which means how many steps? One step or many steps? Many steps. All right, by which glucose is converted into 2-pyruvates or 2-pyruvic acids. Does it require oxygen? No, because it's in the cytosol. What's the only thing that requires oxygen? Where does that happen? In the mitochondria. Okay, so it doesn't require oxygen. Here's the overall net equation of what's happening. Well, we start with glucose, right? And then we start with 2NAD+. And your book never puts a plus right here, which is a shame. You should probably put a plus right here. It'll help you balance out that equation a little bit. 2NAD. What's the job of NAD? What does it carry? Yeah, high energy electrons in the form of energy. Right. So NAD plus is oxidized. It's looking for electrons. Right. So glucose, NAD plus, 2 ADP, 2 inorganic phosphates. And then when it goes through glycolysis, that produces the 2-pyruvates that we were talking about. 2-NADH. All right, and what do you know about NADH? Big, hairy coenzyme that's doing what? Carrying high-energy electrons or energy, right? And then 2-ATP. And you can consider that a coenzyme carrying energy, more energy. Okay, so that's the overall reaction. But I'm sure you're interested in knowing a little bit more details with this. All right, glycolysis, well, we just said, I asked you guys, you told me it's exergonic. It produces 2 ATPs and 2 NADHs. And remember, NADH and ATP both carry energy. However, that glucose must be activated first before glycolysis can proceed. It requires 2 ATPs before the energy can be obtained. All right, and so glucose has to be phosphorylated with 2 ATPs. 2 phosphate groups. And can you remember what a phosphate group looks like? What kind of bonds does it produce? It produces covalent bonds, but what kind of covalent bonds? Polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
So that means that phosphate likes to be in water, right? Can that phosphate group diffuse through the cell membrane? Remember, it's a polar compound. The cell membrane is nonpolar. It's hydrophobic, so anything that's phosphorylated cannot get outside the cell. So this phosphorylation of glucose with those phosphate groups then traps that glucose inside the cell because those phosphate groups can't get through the cell membrane. So that's just way that when a cell absorbs that glucose, it cannot leave. All right, so here is a slide of glycolysis, right? We start with glucose and we end up with what? 2 pyruvic acids. If you want to draw in a little 2 right here, that's fine with me. That's good. And we see that what happens to the energy level of glucose? But does it just start to decrease right away? Energy level has to increase because 2 ATPs are necessary. That energy in ATP is then transferred to glucose because it becomes phosphorylated. Well, how would you conceptualize these 2 steps right here? Think of glycolysis as a reaction, but that reaction can only proceed if we put some energy into the system first. So I think of glucose here, but in order to get it to decompose or catabolize, I have to put a match underneath it to get it to burn. Okay? But your body doesn't use a match, it uses ATP. What does that ATP produce? It produces the activation energy for glycolysis. Right, can you remember that first diagram in the previous chapter? This right here is that little wall that has to be overcome. It's overcome with energy from ATP. Once it reaches this maximum level here, then the molecule glucose can be broken down into pyruvic acid. So from number 1 down to pyruvic acid, is this an exergonic or endergonic reaction? From 1 all the way down. Yeah, that's exergonic, right? Because the products have less energy than the reactants. Energy is released, but fortunately in our bodies it doesn't get converted to heat. It gets converted into other forms of chemical energy like, what's this here? ATP. And this molecule here, which is NADH, right? So that energy doesn't go up in heat, right? It gets trapped in these other molecules. All right, so for every glucose, I see 1, 2, 3, 4 ATPs being produced. But how many ATPs were necessary to get it started? 2. What's the overall net production of ATP from glycolysis? Only 2 ATP. So you could memorize that. All right. And how many NADH? 2 for every glucose. right? And don't forget, there's energy trapped in NADH in the form of high energy electrons. All right, so here is that multi-step enzymatic pathway that we call glycolysis. And anybody print out the study guide yet? I forget, this year, do you have to, is this an exam figure this semester or not? This one right here, do you have to know the names of all these enzymes and everything? I got a feeling you don't have to know that for this semester. Okay, but what do you have to know for glycolysis? Where it takes place? Where does this take place? Cytosol. And what molecule enters glycolysis? Glucose. What molecule leaves? 2 pyruvic acids. All right, but some other things too. What else is produced? 1, 2, 3, 4 ATP minus 2 that were used up. Right, and then 2 NADHs right here. Right, so that's something else that's being produced. Now, I see a bunch of arrows on glycolysis. The solid arrows represent the pathway from glucose to pyruvic acid. And when that happens, you produce 2 NADHs and 2 ATPs when this reaction takes place. Now, can the reaction go the other way? I see some dotted arrows, dotted line arrows. And yes, glycolysis can go in the opposite direction. When glycolysis goes in the opposite direction, what happens to ATP? It gets used up. It's no longer produced. And I think one of the things we talked about last time is how important ATP. How important is ATP in your body? It's super important, right? Because how long can you maintain consciousness when your brain can't resynthesize ATP because oxygen's not getting to it, like when your heart stops? Yeah, 2 seconds, maybe 3 seconds. And then when does your brain die? 2 to 3 minutes, right? So our body is incredibly sensitive to ATP levels, right? So we don't really want glycolysis to go in the reverse direction unless there's a really good reason, unless you have so much ATP that you really don't care. But usually your body needs a lot of ATP. Glycolysis should go in the forward direction. In order for glycolysis to go in the forward direction, what has to be available? Does NADH should be available or NAD plus? Okay. Reverse the forward direction requires NAD plus. If there's no NAD plus inside the cell, then glycolysis can't proceed in the forward direction. Right, so if NADH builds up inside the cell, glycolysis stops. If ATP builds up inside the cell, glycolysis stops. Because what does glycolysis need? It needs ADP. Right, without ADP, NAD plus, glycolysis can't proceed. All right, so what do you think the purpose of glycolysis is, which is really the purpose of this slide right here? Aha, I won't answer that question just yet. All right, so this is glycolysis. Does this happen, do you see any oxygen here anywhere? The question would be, another way of asking that, is this aerobic or anaerobic? Anaerobic does not require oxygen. Okay, so glycolysis is anaerobic, does not require oxygen, and where does it take place? Cytosol, and you know that it produces pyruvic acid, it produces NADH, NADH, right, inhibits the forward flow of glycolysis, right, and it also makes a couple, 2 ATPs. All right, now pyruvic acid from that initial figure that we looked at, how many fates does it have? It's got 2, right? It's got 2 fates, one under anaerobic conditions and one under aerobic conditions. Let's look at anaerobic conditions first, and then we'll figure out why that is. So here's pyruvic acid. Right, 1, 2, 3 carbons, just like we predicted it would. And it's an acid because I see a nice carboxyl group right here. Right. Pyruvic acid by itself cannot leave the cell. And if it builds up inside the cell, for instance, under anaerobic conditions, it can't enter mitochondria. Right, pyruvic can only enter mitochondria under aerobic conditions. But if the cell is anaerobic, pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell. What else builds up inside the cell besides pyruvic acid under anaerobic conditions? NADH builds up inside the cell. And because of Le Chatelier's principle, if the products build up, that will force the reaction in the reverse direction. Right? And so that will inhibit glycolysis, and then that will inhibit ATP production. So your cells don't want to have pyruvic acid built up or NADH built up, because then it can't make ATP. Here's a reaction that helps prevent that from happening. This is called a fermentation reaction because it does not require oxygen. So here we have pyruvic acid, here we have NADH, and with an enzyme called lactate dehydrogenase, LDH reaction, it can take these electrons from NADH, right, and donate them to pyruvic acid, in which case then it becomes lactic acid. How many carbons are in lactic acid? Three. How many in pyruvic acid? Three. Is this a decarboxylation reaction? It is not. There's no CO2 that's being produced. So the energy of lactic acid and pyruvic acid are almost identical. The free energy change is identical. So this reaction right here, you should put a double arrow. This reaction can go forwards and backwards. This should be a double arrow as well right here. And what determines which way this reaction goes is by Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. As pyruvic acid builds up, that forces the reaction to the right. As lactic acid builds up, that forces the reaction to the left. Right. So, this anaerobic respiration, what does it do for NADH? Does it use up NADH, or does it produce NADH? It uses up NADH, and it produces NAD+. Now, what good is NAD+ inside the cytosol? It's necessary for the forward direction of glycolysis. Right? So this lactate dehydrogenase pathway, right, gets rid of pyruvic acid, so there's no endpoint inhibition for glycolysis, and it also regenerates NAD+, so that glycolysis can proceed in the forward direction. And what's the beauty of glycolysis proceeding in the forward direction? What's being produced? ATP. Right? So if NAD plus was not regenerated, then the cell couldn't make any ATP by glycolysis. Right, so that's the beauty of this anaerobic respiration pathway. Lactic acid can leave the cell, and we're going to see where it goes in a little bit. It goes to the liver. Right, so pyruvic acid is dealt with, right? NADH is dealt with, because pyruvic acid then leaves the cell in the form of lactic acid, and then NADH is regenerated into NAD+, so that glycolysis still can proceed in the forward direction to make ATP. That's the beauty of that anaerobic pathway. And we call that the lactic acid pathway. You do another kind of fermentation reaction in lab, which I'm really fond of this reaction right here, but I might be even more fond of the other reaction that some organisms can undergo. They get rid of pyruvic acid via an alcohol dehydrogenase reaction, which is a decarboxylation step. Oh, do I have time to talk about that? Oh, just a little bit. It's kind of fun. Let me turn the lights on just a second. Oh, it takes a while for these lights to turn on. All right, so we got pyruvic acid, right, which is what, three carbons? I can do this in just short form. Three carbons by pyruvic acid. Okay, what some organisms do is that it takes pyruvic acid, right, and it gets rid of NADH, produces NAD+, and then it produces CO2. Turn the mic down just a little bit. Produces CO2 and this compound. Anybody know what this thing is called? Oh, just one line, H, and then an OH right here. What's that? Okay, that's almost like everybody's favorite molecule. That is ethyl alcohol, alcohol, and that's adult beverage, okay? Now, what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? Makes us happy, okay? Alcohol. Now, would you want to have a lot of ethyl alcohol before an exam, for instance? No, you'd be way too happy. It might help, okay? But you might be way too happy. I mean happy. Because ethyl alcohol is an intoxicant. It's toxic to our nervous system. Our nervous system can't function with ethyl alcohol, right? So our body doesn't undergo this alcohol fermentation reaction because it produces something that's toxic to our body. So what does our body do? Because it doesn't want to produce ethyl alcohol, it produces lactic acid instead. Right? So that's a decarboxylation reaction. So this reaction is produced by yeast, for instance. They don't have a nervous system. They don't really care if they're in an environment of ethyl alcohol because it's not toxic to them. But what would you use this reaction for? A couple reasons. What would you use yeast for? Well, to make adult beverage, beer, champagne, wine, that kind of stuff. But what about this CO2? That puts bubbles in beer, right? Bubbles in champagne. But what else is this CO2 good for? For making bread rise. Right? So if you live near a bakery, what do you smell? You smell a lot of alcohol coming out and other kinds of hydrocarbons coming out of a bakery. That's why they might even be illegal in LA County now because of stringent air quality control. So this is a fermentation reaction because you see oxygen being used right here. No oxygen. And the beauty is that it regenerates NAD so that glycolysis can still happen inside that yeast cell. And when glycolysis happens inside that yeast cell, what else is being produced? ATP. Okay. And this is a really good thing that we don't have an alcohol dehydrogenase pathway in our body. Why is that? Why is it a really good thing? Or why is it a bad thing? It's maybe a good or bad depending on your point of view, because what would happen to you if you were to hold your breath if you had alcohol dehydrogenase? You would become intoxicated. Right? As soon as you hold your breath, everything would become anaerobic, and then your cells would start to produce CO2 and ethyl alcohol. And, of course, that's toxic to your nervous system. And we'd all be drunk if we were to hold our breath for, like, 30 seconds or something. Not such a good idea, right? Or would that be a good idea? I don't know. Maybe with some genetic engineering, we could generate a nice metabolic pathway to where that could be something we could do on a weekend. Okay, but generally not. All right, so lactic acid pathway just produces lactic acid from pyruvate, regenerating NAD+ for glycolysis. What does it do? Lactic acid pathway allows glycolysis to proceed, which produces 2-ATP. And what about that NADH that carries those high energy electrons? Well, it gets used up. So that's not useful, but those 2-ATPs are useful. Red blood cells don't have any organelles because they're completely filled up with hemoglobin. They don't have mitochondria, right? Red blood cells only work anaerobically through this lactic acid pathway. Red blood cells can make ATP, but only 2 for every glucose molecule. Lactic acid pathway also occurs in heart and skeletal muscle when oxygen falls below a certain level, when those cells become anaerobic. For instance, when somebody's having a heart attack, then some ATP can be produced, not enough usually to keep the heart muscle functioning and maybe not even alive. And during heavy exercise, when you contract a muscle, say like this biceps right here that I'm contracting, it turns into this amazing solid mass of material. It's not just a fluid tissue. When it's a solid mass, blood can't even get into it. No oxygen can get into that muscle. So what conditions is that muscle operating in when I'm contracting it? Quick, tell me. Anaerobic, right? And so lactic acid is being produced by that muscle right there because blood can't get into it, oxygen can't get into it, and of course the buildup of that lactic acid is painful. So I'm glad you told me right away what was happening. Okay, so that's the importance of the anaerobic pathway in the cytosol. Before we get to aerobic respiration, I want to talk about these two terms right here. Which pathway did we just get done talking about? Lactic acid pathway. And before that, my question wasn't really exact enough, but before that was glycolysis, which is what? The snipping of glucose into two pieces. Here we have a couple other things. glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. This lysis right here you're familiar with, that's the breakdown. Genesis means the making, the creation of something, and it's the creation of glycogen. Glycogenesis and glycogenolysis is, well, first one is the production of glycogen, and glycogenolysis is the breakdown of glycogen. What's the building block of glycogen? I've mentioned it, but we haven't really thought about it. But the is glucose. Yeah, glucose is the building block of glycogen. So, in order for glycogenesis to take place, it needs glucose. Glycogenolysis takes place when you need what? Glucose. All right. So, glycogen is just the storage form of glucose in our body. All right. So, for osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucose molecules. All right. So, let's just take a cell. A normal cell, put it in normal saline, normal isotonic saline, and let's put a couple million of molecules of glucose inside the cell. All right, so we've got a normal cell, let's put a couple million molecules inside the cell. Now what's going to happen to that cell? Is water going to move one way or the other across the membrane? If we put solute inside the cell, what's going to happen to the cell if we now put millions of molecules of glucose inside that cell? Glucose is good, right? But what's going to happen to that cell? Well, water's going to go in, right, to dilute that glucose out. Because water now is low inside the cell, high outside because of all that glucose inside the cell. So if a lot of glucose enters the cell, water is going to rush in, and what's going to happen to the cell? It's going to burst. All right, so what does your body do with all those millions of molecules of glucose? It jams them together into one molecule, namely glycogen, and now water won't want to go into the cell because there's only one solute particle, not millions. So that is why glucose is stored as glycogen. All right, and that's what we mean by osmotic reasons. You can't have all those individual glucose molecules inside a cell because it will swell up and burst. All right, so glucose then is used to make glycogen called, that process is called glycogenesis. All right, the skeletal muscles and liver store a lot of glycogen in our bodies, and when a cell needs glucose, it goes to glycogen and it takes one glucose off at a time. We call that glycogenolysis, the breakdown of glycogen. And what's produced via glycogenolysis? It is glucose in the form of glucose 6-phosphate. That's just a glucose with one phosphate at what carbon? The first carbon, the second carbon, the third one, the sixth one. That's what that name means right there. Okay, just on right on the end. And remember that phosphate group is highly hydrophilic, which means it can't get through the cell membrane, so that glucose is still trapped inside the cell. It cannot leave. Here are some terms that I want you to be familiar with. All right, glycolysis we talked about, talked a little bit about glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. Here's another term, gluconeogenesis. So glucogenesis is what? The making of glucose, but what kind of glucose? Neo is new, the making of new glucose inside your body. So not only do we get glucose from our diet, but our bodies can actually make glucose. That's really important because some people have a real problem with having too much glucose in their blood. What kind of condition is that?
Diabetes.
Yeah, diabetes mellitus, right? So somebody with untreated diabetes mellitus, their blood glucose is way too high. It might be due to diet, but it could also be due to gluconeogenesis. Their own body produces too much glucose, and then it can't leave the blood. So there are different ways to treat diabetes. One is to inhibit gluconeogenesis with various drugs, and the other is to control your diet. All right, so gluconeogenesis, production of new glucose. Lipogenesis, what's a lipid? A fat. So lipogenesis is what? The making of fat, okay? And in particular, the kind of fat that I want you to be aware of is a triglyceride, all right? So lipid in this form is a triglyceride. What can you tell me about a triglyceride? What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? A glycerin and three fatty acids. Yeah, so don't forget, a fatty acid is considered a lipid, but not really in the sense of this chapter. I want you to think of a lipid as a triglyceride and a fatty acid as another kind of lipid, all right, but a different kind. All right, and lipogenesis makes triglycerides from glycerin and three fatty acids. What about lipolysis? It's the opposite of lipogenesis. So lipolysis works on what kind of molecule? Okay, a lipid. And what did we define as a lipid? Triglyceride specifically, not fatty acid, right? So lipolysis will take a triglyceride and break it down into glycerin and three fatty acids, right? That's what lipolysis does. Now, fatty acids can be broken down, but that's a different kind of pathway that's not on this list right here. So just really be aware that lipolysis is the breakdown of a triglyceride in particular, not the breakdown of a fatty acid. Ketogenesis, maybe we'll get to talk about that a little bit, but that's a breakdown of fatty acids under anaerobic conditions. We can get some energy from that, but it produces ketone bodies. For instance, acetone, fingernail polish remover, is one of those compounds that our bodies can produce when we can't metabolize glucose well, and we can only metabolize fatty acids. Maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. So we got glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis. And so these things will definitely be on the test. So if you don't, if you can't see the difference between these words, all right, then you need better reading glasses right away, because you've got to be really familiar with these terms. And that's okay. Sometimes when I say one of these terms, I have to stop and think for a second what they mean, right? And I'm sure you guys will have to do the same thing. But just be able to write down the definition. Let's just go over it really fast. Glycolysis is what? Glycolysis is breakdown of glucose, breakdown, lysis of glucose. Glycogenesis is the production of glycogen. Glycogenolysis is the breakdown of glycogen. And gluconeogenesis is the production of glucose, new glucose. And glycolysis produces, what does glycolysis produce? It gets snipped into pyruvate. Guess what gluconeogenesis needs to make glucose? It needs two pyruvates that get joined together. Okay? And you saw that actually on this slide right here, right? This dotted line, the dotted arrows going up to glucose represent gluconeogenesis. The solid arrows represent glycolysis. Right? And so you see that they're antagonistic to each other, which means that this reaction right here maintains a balance, a metabolic balance inside your cells, an energy balance. Okay. All right, so be familiar with those terms. So let's start to work with some of those terms to get a better understanding of what they're all about. Okay, so I have a cell that sort of has a red shaded background. And the cell right here is maybe any typical kind of cell. It could be a muscle cell, could be a liver cell, could be any kind of cell in a number of different tissues. All right, and we have glucose 6-phosphate. So here's the glucose that has been phosphorylated, so it's trapped inside the cell, can't leave. And if this cell has plenty of energy, plenty of ATP, then this glucose is not going to be metabolized or catabolized, it's going to be stored. How is this glucose going to be stored? Right? It's going to be converted into this G1P, glucose 1-phosphate. That's not such an important step to know. But that glucose then can be added to make glycogen. Right? And so this glucose 1-phosphate will be dephosphorylated. The glucose, this plain old glucose, will be added to glycogen, so it's going to be glycogen plus 1-glucose. What kind of enzyme is number 1 right here? You already know the name of this enzyme just by knowing some nomenclature and a couple of other definitions that we talked about even today. What removes a phosphate from a molecule like glucose 1-phosphate? That's a phosphatase. And so the name of this enzyme is what? Glucose 1-phosphatase. Because we use the name of the substrate, we know it's a phosphatase, and so we know what this is, this number 1 is. But we also know, what else could number 1 be? What's the name of this pathway? Not just the name of the enzyme, but this is? It has to do with glycogen, and is it the breakdown or the production of? Production. So this is glycogenesis. Number 1 is glycogenesis. All right. All right, what is number 2? What kind of enzyme is used for number two? It adds a phosphate. That's a kinase, right? So a kinase will chop off a glucose. Actually, it's a series of reactions right here, but there's a kinase reaction, right, that phosphorylates glucose, turns it into glucose 1. And what's a better way of thinking of this arrow right here? It's not glycogenesis, it is what? Glycogenolysis, yeah, it's the breakdown of glycogen, right? So these are antagonistic to each other. That produces glucose 1 phosphate. That can get rearranged to glucose 6 phosphate, and the energy of these two molecules are the same, so the arrows can go up or down depending on Le Chatelier's principle. So now we have glucose 6 phosphate inside the cell. If this cell is needing ATP, then glucose 6 phosphate can enter glycolysis, right, and produce pyruvic acid and generate some ATP for the cell. But if the cell has plenty of energy, and if it's the liver cell, and other cells need glucose, like muscle, then glucose 6-phosphate can be dephosphorylated, right, and then glucose can leave the cell and go into the blood because it doesn't have that phosphate group on it anymore. What kind of enzyme does the liver have that no other cells, no other organs have? It takes a phosphate off, which is what? A phosphatase, and there's your substrate, so we would call this glucose 6-phosphatase, right? And that's only found in the liver so that glucose can leave the liver, go into the blood, and then, of course, muscles then have access to that glucose, and those cells can make ATP for muscle contraction. Okay, so that's only one last thing remaining. If this is a cell, any kind of cell, muscle or liver, and it wants to take glucose up. So here we have glucose in the blood, and it enters the cell. What's necessary for this step right here? What's necessary for this step? You all know what it is. Okay? It needs a passport signal. This glucose needs a passport to enter the cell. It needs, yeah, that hormone that we call insulin, right? So when insulin is present, glucose can enter a cell, and the cell is really greedy. It doesn't ever want to get rid of that glucose. How does that happen? It is phosphorylated using ATP. So what would we call this enzyme that phosphorylates glucose to make a glucose 6-phosphate? Going from glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, the name of this enzyme is? Yeah, glucose kinase, because it phosphorylates glucose. And then glucose is now trapped inside the cell. Only the liver can secrete glucose. No other cell ever gives up glucose because that's an important energy molecule. All right, so here is the importance of glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. And then let's use that previous slide to understand something about the Cori cycle. This is an exam figure two, and we should know all the little steps that are taking place. We have two different cell types. We've got skeletal muscle on the left, we got liver cells on the right, and of course we got glycogen, glucose 6 phosphate, pyruvic, lactic acid in all of these cells right here. And let's just say that we have a muscle and it is exercising. How does it get ATP? It can get it from glucose, right, via glycolysis, because glycolysis makes some ATP. So when the cell is exercising, it takes up glucose from the blood. It can also get glucose from glycogen. All right, so what is that process of getting glucose from glycogen? Like number one right here, what is that called? Glycogenolysis, it's the breakdown of glycogen. Like glycolysis is the breakdown of glucose, glycogenolysis is the breakdown of glycogen. So number one is glycogenolysis. Produces glucose 6-phosphate. So glucose going to pyruvate. Number two is called glycolysis, right? Glucose to pyruvate is glycolysis. Pyruvate to lactic acid is lactate dehydrogenase reaction, or LDH reaction. All right, what about glucose to glycogen? Number nine. Glycogenesis. Yeah, that's glycogenesis. Glycogenesis happens during rest when the cell doesn't need energy or ATP. Right? Glycogenolysis, number one right here, happens when the cell needs energy and it can make it from glucose. All right. All right, so the cell is, let's just say this exercising muscle is operating anaerobically because it's operating very strenuously. Oxygen can't get into the muscle, right? And so pyruvic acid then is converted into lactic acid that regenerates NAD+ so that glycolysis can stay open, gets rid of pyruvic acid so that glycolysis can stay open and produce some ATP for us. Pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, but lactic acid can. Lactic acid goes into the blood, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere in your body, and it gets to the liver takes it up. So now you have lactic acid inside a liver cell, and it converts it into pyruvic acid. So what's number five? It is the same as number three. It is the lactate dehydrogenase pathway, right? And remember, there's no energy change between pyruvic acid and lactic acid, so this arrow can go up, it can go down, all depending on the concentration of these different reactants by Le Chatelier's principle or law of mass action. All right, so lactic to pyruvic acid is the LDH reaction. Pyruvate going to make glucose. Number six is, we just learned what that is. It is gluco, making of new glucose. Gluconeogenesis, right? So six is gluconeogenesis. And then the up arrows and down arrows over here are the same as in muscle. So the up arrow, glucose-6-phosphate, the glycogen is what? Glycogenesis. And the down arrow from glycogen to glucose is glycogenolysis. Right? Glycogenolysis. One last thing, number seven. We haven't talked about seven. What kind of enzyme takes glucose-6-phosphate and makes glucose out of it? Glucose-6-phosphatase. Not a kinase, but a phosphatase. All right. So, what's interesting about this is that even under anaerobic conditions, right, these skeletal muscles can operate because they get some ATP, but the burden is then deferred to the liver. The liver never runs out of oxygen. Right, so the liver then takes that lactic acid, makes glucose back out of it. The glucose goes back to that exercising muscle, and with glycolysis, it can make a couple ATP so that it can still stay operational. And then that lactic acid goes back to the liver. The liver needs a lot of oxygen and ATP for gluconeogenesis, but then that glucose gets shipped back to this skeletal muscle, so the skeletal muscle still can contract, even under anaerobic conditions. So the Cori cycle is pretty important. So when you're exercising strenuously, you're contracting muscles all over your body, you're sweating like crazy, and you're working out these skeletal muscles in your heart, what other organ are you working out? Okay, your lungs, sure, because you need a lot of oxygen. What organ in your body needs a lot of oxygen? It's not muscles, because blood can't even get to those muscles when they're working really hard. Your heart, yeah, but your heart is contracting too. A lot of oxygen can't get to your heart. Okay, your brain, yeah, a lot of oxygen is always going to your brain. But I see it on this slide right here. What other organ are you working out? You're working out your liver, because that's part of the Cori cycle. So when you're working out and muscles are producing a lot of lactic acid, what organ is working just as hard? Your liver right here, converting that lactic acid back to glucose, which then gets shipped back to your skeletal muscles for contraction. All right, so that's not a commonly understood kind of cycle, that when you exercise strenuously or anaerobically, what other organ is so important? It is your liver, because of the Cori cycle right here. Okay. You guys might have to look at this, but if you have a question right now, this is a great time to ask a question. Yeah. Right here. Yeah. Yeah, hydrogen ions? Yeah, sure, because even if the liver is absolutely neutral, what does that mean? You have 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar hydrogen ions in solution. So there's plenty of hydrogen ions there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the same thing over here. Yeah. And, of course, then there are buffers in the liver. So when the hydrogen ion concentration decreases, the liver becomes more alkaline, then those buffers then maintain the pH to where it should be. Replaces those hydrogen ions. Yeah. All right, so next time you go for a nice jog or lift weights or something, When you think about those muscles contracting, just appreciate how important it is to have a good functioning liver. Okay. And I can think of one easy way to damage your liver and kill your liver. Does anybody know a real easy way how to kill your liver? This little beast right here. Okay? Because we're going to see in the next lecture that ethyl alcohol has only two fates. There's only two possibilities for ethyl alcohol. It can be metabolized into carbon dioxide and make ATP, but if your body stores it, it can only store it as a lipid, can't store it as a protein, can't store it as a sugar molecule, so that when we drink adult beverage, it's like eating a bar of butter. And the only organ that can deal with ethyl alcohol is your liver, so when you drink a lot of alcohol, what happens to your liver? It becomes fatty, and then it can become cirrhotic, and then it can turn cancerous, right? Or it can just die. And I've probably known quite a few people to drink themselves to death just by drinking a six-pack of beer every day. Right, so it's a pretty toxic compound, not just for our nervous system, but for our liver as well. All right, what time are we out of here? 5 minutes? 12:45, we're done? Okay, so where we're going to start next time is aerobic respiration. Where is that on that slide? What part of the cell does aerobic respiration take place? Mitochondria, that's right. So what enters the mitochondria under aerobic conditions? Oxygen, sure, oxygen's got to be there. But another metabolite, which is? Pyruvic acid from glycolysis can enter that mitochondria. Okay, so what we're going to look at next time is this last row on this slide right here. This is aerobic respiration, and a lot of Nobel Prizes were won by people investigating this last row right here. So you should be pretty excited to see what's going on here. In the meantime, tell me, what is the purpose of all this stuff that we drew out on this particular slide? Okay? You probably know, don't say it out loud, but I'll ask you first thing next time. It's not on this slide, but the most important thing you should be able to draw on this slide. What's the purpose of all of this? Okay? Is it to produce CO2?
No.
Produce water? No. Okay. To get rid of glucose?
No.
Yeah, question. All of these that we see right here are exorganic. All right, so these are exorganic, that which means that they do not require ATP. These reactions do not require ATP. That's a hint.
Well, what is the energy?
I like what I'm hearing. I just don't want to form. So sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Hi. I don't know, which week is that? I'm not sure I know. I haven't memorized all that. Is that for this week? Do you have time to look right?